You've been doing some book buying.
Sure have.
What sort of things have you been picking up?
Well, you'd be surprised. Some books about drumming for my kid.
Drumming?
Yeah. My son is a drummer.
Do you live with your kids?
Yeah.
And he's got a drum?
He has a whole drum. He has eight drums. He's a drummer.
Don DeLillo's new book.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's his new one, Running Dog. I haven't read him. Is he good?
I don't know his work. I know his reputation.
Yeah, I've been reading reviews of his books, and I thought, well, time has come.
Yeah, I know he has a new book out, and
bought the mailer book. Dead Men Don't Shoot Horses.
78.
Yeah, Tough Guys Don't.
Oh, yeah.
I was with someone else, Sea Boy. I ordinarily eat potatoes. I don't buy hardback books. I wait for the paperbacks. And I read them, and then if I really like them, then I buy the hardback.
Okay, let's talk. It was several years ago, and I don't remember the date, that I spoke to you last. You wouldn't remember me because I was in a group of around 50 reporters, and it was the day that you were released from the Federal Detention Center in Manhattan. You remember that day?
I do. I was a happy man.
Yeah, you were happy that day. And I think we chased after you, but you talked to us, I think. I think you talked to us. At least I remember swarms of reporters going after you, and I think you spoke to us.
Sure I did. I knew you guys were doing your job. Never shy. That was 1974. And as a matter of fact, it was Valentine's Day that I was officially released and put on parole.
That was a good day for you. How long were you in?
I was in jail for 16 and a half months and then about six more weeks in that halfway house, which was a crummy hotel on the west side.
That was where it was, yes.
Yep.
That was where it was that we saw you in this hotel. Well, that was 10 years ago. A lot of time has passed since that day and all of those controversial events that led to your imprisonment. Where did you go on that day, 1974, after you left the halfway house?
Well, I went straight to my lawyer's apartment on Central Park South, a luxurious apartment, and I had a drink and waited for my kids to arrive from Spain. And then I settled down to take care of them and reconstruct my life, which I have been doing ever since.
Where did you decide to go?
I lived then in East Hampton for a couple of years. I was physically unable to leave the country very often because of the parole restrictions. Then I moved to Mexico, went back to Europe for a while. I'm a traveler. I can't live for more than two or three years in one place without getting very restless. And now I'm back in Mexico again. The only consistent theme of that whole time has been my writing. Because no matter where I go, I keep writing books.
Where are you living in Mexico?
A small town called San Miguel Allende, which is on the high plateau, 6,000 feet up, about 4 hours drive north of Mexico City.
Why did you select that town?
Well, it's beautiful. It's cheap to live there. It has a poetic ambiance. And I like Latin places.
You're the father of three sons. Do they live with you or with their mother?
I have two of my sons living with me. My oldest son works in London, and the other kids who are 16 and 14 are now with me going to a bilingual, bicultural school in Mexico until they're ready for university in the States.
What's it like living in San Miguel Allende?
It's very quiet for me. I rarely go out. I get up in the morning, work most of the day, have a big garden. I play some tennis, do some riding in the mountains. And every two or three months when I feel I'm going to go crazy, I come to New York to talk to people.
Buy books.
And buy books. Buy them and sell them.
You went to East Hampton after your release, and as you said, you started to rebuild your life. You obviously had to start rebuilding your life through writing. Tell me about some of your work during this period.
The first book I had published during that period was a spy novel which I wrote with Herbert Burkholz called The Death Freak. We subsequently wrote a sequel to it called The Sleeping Spy. But the major works of this 10-year period have been two novels, one called Tom Mix and Pancho Villa, which was published a couple of years ago and is just out in paperback and is being made into a movie in Hollywood, and the book that I've been working on for the last several years, The Angel of Zin, which is published around Thanksgiving time by Stein and Day. And that's the most serious book I've ever written. I put the most effort into it, and I'm most pleased with it.
I want to ask you some questions about The Angel of Zin after we get some biographical data behind us. Did you find any resistance from publishers or indeed from readers and critics to your work after the Howard Hughes scandal?
I found quite a lot of resistance from some publishers. Many editors or publishers did not want to publish me. They felt I had besmirched the establishment. Didn't like it at all. And at first they didn't admit to my face that they wouldn't publish me, but they did after a while, and I learned from some of them. Critics, no. Critics have always been very fair, and I've gotten very good reviews. Readers, who can tell?
Readers what?
I can't tell, because I'm rarely in contact with the readers. There is, unfortunately, a tremendous gap between the writer and his reading public.
Well, there may be a gap in terms of direct communication, but that is easily overcome through sales. You can tell by the amount of books that you sell whether or not you are reaching your readers.
So you can only tell what kind of a job your publicist and publisher is doing. You can't tell if people are reading your book and enjoying your book. I have come across many bestsellers, and I can't find anyone who likes the book. They bought them because the book was high on the bestseller list, and people tend to buy what is on the bestseller list. They follow the crowd. That doesn't mean they read them.
That's true. The autobiography of Howard Hughes, you have listed it almost proudly here on the Also by Clifford Irving page across from the title page. Why was that book never published? Wouldn't that have been a very interesting thing to read with the proper
warning? Allow me, if I may, to correct you. It isn't pride. It's acceptance of reality that makes me put it there. I don't want people to think I'm avoiding the past, and I certainly don't want them to think I'm coveting the past, because it's dead. It's gone. Why was the book never published? I think it's curiously out of date. And was out of date the moment it was revealed to be a hoax. I had a couple of probes by publishers then who, for opportunistic reasons, wanted to publish the book. I wasn't keen to at the time because I thought, enough of this. I'm trying to live this down, not trying to make more profit out of it and more notoriety out of it. And when that time had passed, then I think people no longer care about it.
Were there any legal restraints, or it could have been published as a fiction?
There were some legal questions, and they were resolved in a lawsuit which I won, in which I had the right to publish the book. And the moment I was awarded the right to publish the book, I lost all interest in it for the reasons that I just mentioned.
You did detail this period in your life in Fake, didn't you?
No, Fake is the story of Elmer DeHorry, who was an art forger.
Oh, the hoax. I'm sorry.
In the hoax, yes.
In the hoax.
Yes.
So in a way, you have unburdened yourself of this period, haven't you?
I think so. Thank God I wrote that book, otherwise I wouldn't remember what happened then. I have to refer to it sometimes if people ask me questions about that period, because it's a long time ago. And it was traumatic, and I suppose psychologically I have no great desire to recall it in detail.
Are you tired of people like myself asking you questions about it?
Yes, I certainly am. But you can't blame me. If you had done something 10 or 12 years ago that you weren't particularly proud of, and everyone kept asking you over and over again for details, you'd say, for God's sakes, leave me alone. You know, it's done. I paid my dues. And I did.
You did that. Clifford Irving in The Angel of Zin. You write, where's the line? It's a wonderful line. It should be right here at the top. It is necessary to view the murderers not as beasts, but as men and women who abdicated their humanity in favor of warped visions, etc., etc. Tell me a little bit about how you see the Germans and their role in the Holocaust.
For many years, I had a very unclear picture of the Germans' role in the Holocaust because I knew many Germans, both older people who were there at the time and, of course, said I had nothing to do with it, or I knew it was going on, but I disapproved, and younger Germans who said, well, that has nothing to do with me. That was a long time ago. Why do you Americans, you Jews, keep mentioning it all the time? And it has troubled me, not only as to how a relatively civilized people like the Germans could do what they did, but how it was possible for any human being to live with the awareness of what was going on, to abdicate humanity, and simply say, well, it has nothing to do with me. And I, in the course of researching the Angel of Zinn, I talked with a number of Germans, a number of survivors of the death camps, and I began to realize what I had probably suspected from the beginning, that we are all capable of abdication when it's necessary for survival. Faced with the choice of dying or going on living at the cost of the realization of horror, we will all say, okay, it's horrible what's going on, but I don't want to have anything to do with it. I want to live. Now, I shouldn't say we all will, because many, many are unable to do so. Many sacrifice their lives at that point. The Germans, as a group, an ethnic group, chose to live, chose survival no matter what the cost. It's possible that we in America might make the same choice.
Clifford Irving, in The Angel of Zinn, a German military officer goes to a concentration camp to investigate some murders. Do you make this officer a hero?
Yes, he is. What I conceived of the officer, Paul Bock, as a fundamentally decent man. He's a homicide inspector for the Berlin Criminal Police, taken into the SS in 1936, overnight, not by choice. At the same time, he's a man who does turn his back on the horror of his times. And he is a decent man. However, when faced with the reality of what's happening in his own country, when made aware of the role that he plays, willingly or unwillingly, he realizes that he could have done a lot better in life. And in that sense, he's like all of us.
What is the significance of the title, The Angel of Zinn?
Zinn is the death camp, an amalgamation of several camps, a shortening of a long Polish name. And the murderer, the man who leaves the notes, which starts the homicide investigation at the camp, is dubbed by the camp commandant the Angel of Death. And since it's basically the story of the murders that he commits and that are solved by the SS inspector, I titled the book The Angel of Sin.
Had you gone to Germany? Had you seen the concentration camps yourself?
Yes, I've seen them in Germany and in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
I went there about 2 years ago to do the field research.
How long had you been working on The Angel of Sin?
The book took it about 2 years to write. But I've been thinking about it for many years. Books, how long a writer takes to write them is almost immaterial. They cook in your brain and in your psyche sometimes for a decade or more.
Precisely what Thoreau said. The Mosquito Coast, for example, which you cited, was a book that he had written in his mind. Before he sat down at the typewriter, he had no outline. He knew the characters. He had already been to Honduras for the Not on the Set. And he just started writing. That's all he had to do. Do you find that is the pattern with you, or are you a type of writer who makes copious notes and outlines the chapters?
I make copious notes and outlines, and I usually abandon them about halfway through. But it's good to have the illusion that you're following an outline, that you're an orderly person. Then you can veer from it. And good writers do veer from it all the time, because the characters take over and insist that they go in one direction rather than the direction that you have pre-planned for them. And you've got to listen to them.
You're comfortable writing just about anywhere then, huh?
Oh, yes. Just sit me down at a table with a good light and I can work anywhere.
Typewriter? Word processor?
I use typewriter. And sometimes I write by hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to me about The Angel of Zen, comparing notes, giving me a little bit of your background over the past 10 years since I saw you last. And it looks like things are going well. You have your life back on a straight course, can we say that?
Oh, yes. Well, not too straight. I mean, I don't want to, it's not boring. But it's on the level.
Clifford Irving, wish you the best of luck with The Angel of Zen, and thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you, Doug.